As George said, many of us who are here this evening were at Vic Milione's memorial service this afternoon, and some of us were at Bill Buckley's memorial mass in New York City just 1 week ago. And of course, this is all one story. As Ed Fulner pointed out this afternoon, Bill's early connection with ISI is not widely remembered, but that was a story that he loved to tell. As Bill put it, Frank Chodorov told me one day that I would be the president of the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, as ISI was originally named. Bill continued, it was my habit in those days to do anything Frank asked, and so for a while I was president of ISI. Then one day I got a note from him, a note that sticks easily to the memory. It said, Dear Bill, you're fired. I've decided a Jew would do better at fundraising as president of ISI, so I have appointed myself. Love, Frank. In fact, Frank was not very good at fundraising, and eventually he was succeeded by Vic Milione, his longtime deputy, who was not Jewish, but a Catholic of Italian and Irish descent. But he wasn't very good at fundraising either. But he was a very successful president in all other respects, and in due course, he handed over to Ken Cribb a thriving, if somewhat threadbare, enterprise. Now, Ken Cribb has been extremely successful, even though he is a Methodist of English, Scots, and French Huguenot descent. And come to think of it, Bill, a Catholic of Irish and Swiss descent, did pretty well, too, not to be sure at ISI, but in keeping his beloved National Review afloat, though, as he was the first to admit, barely. As he put it at his grand 80th birthday party 2 years ago, I think there may be an extrasensory perception at work, guiding our friends to look after only our exact and direst needs. Extrasensory perception because we are never with a dollar left over. And of course, the connection between ISI and the Philadelphia Society is, as Bill might have put it, umbilical. Back in 1964, in the middle of the Goldwater campaign, a young Hoosier named Don Lipsett, who had worked for Bill in the early days of National Review, was Midwest director of ISI. At that time, ISI was focused even more exclusively on students than it is now that it has that impressive publishing arm. And Don saw the need for an organization for older conservatives. The following year, he and his old friend Ed Fulner, who was studying at the Wharton Business School, managed to get Bill together with Milton Friedman in a New York hotel room. Incidentally, that was the first meeting of Milton and Bill, who became such great friends and skiing buddies. Anyway, Bill and Milton agreed that the new organization Don and Ed were promoting sounded like a good thing. But what I love about this story is a mistake that Bill made when he told it. He said, and this mistake was absolutely characteristic of him in understating his own generosity. The way he put it, speaking to the Society's annual meeting in 1991, was, it was almost 30 years ago that Ed Fulner and I each put up $50 to incorporate the Philadelphia Society. I swear, I remember there's been, what is it, 6 times inflation and then another couple of times after that, so this was, you know, a fair amount of money. Bill concluded, I swear I never got a bigger bang for a buck. Ed agrees with the second part of that assessment, but points out that graduate students in 1965 didn't have $50 as to spare. The $100, he tells me, all came from Bill. Ed's contribution was to take it to the bank and start an account. I reckon there are members of 4 generations present here this evening, and I imagine that for most of you in the younger cohorts, William F. Buckley Jr. is mostly a name seen on the spines of books or at the top of the newspaper column that he wrote till the end of his life. But for those of us, the older ones, who were following Bill in his glory days, roughly the period when he hosted Firing Line from 1966 to 1999, he was a phenomenon like nothing we had seen. He was everywhere, from late-night TV with Johnny Carson to the irreverent primetime laugh-in. He was interviewed by Playboy at about the same time as he was editing a serious volume of conservative writings of the 20th century, which, however, he cheekily titled, Did You Ever See a Dream Walking? In the 1950s, he had devoted most of his time to National Review, first raising the money to start it, and then being its hands-on editor. He did not write a book between 1954, McCarthy and His Enemies, and 1959, Up from Liberalism. But by that time, NR had survived its infancy, and Bill had loyal and extremely competent deputies, James Burnham and his own sister Priscilla, so he was able to branch out. Besides the column and the television and the speaking circuit, which took him to every state of the union, he also turned out a book nearly every year. And in the years that he didn't turn out a book, he sometimes turned out a second one the following year. One of those books back in 1971 was an account of a week in his life. He titled it Cruising Speed, and many admirers took that as an appropriate description of Bill's own life. Eventually, of course, his cruising speed had to slow down. He stopped doing Firing Line in 1999 and said farewell to the lecture circuit in 2001. But he still wrote his column to the end. True, he was on leave from the column at the time he died because of a broken bone in his right hand. But he was due to resume writing it the following Tuesday. And he still wrote books. Flying High, a memoir of Barry Goldwater, was published 3 weeks after Bill died. And he had just finished drafting a similar memoir of Ronald Reagan, dictating the last three chapters because of that broken bone. We're pretty sure he wrote enough that it will be publishable. Look for it about a year from now. And even though he had slowed down, his habits of mind hadn't changed. The last conversation I had with him was on the afternoon before he died. He had been in New York City that morning for a doctor's appointment. And when he returned home to Connecticut, he left behind his pocket diary and phone book. Late that afternoon, he phoned me and asked me to FedEx it to him. Sure, I can do that, I said. But remember, Jerry, that was his driver, is going to be bringing out some guests tomorrow. Can't he bring it? Well, no, said Bill. It would reach me 5 hours later that way. Bill never wavered in his love for the Philadelphia Society or his judgment of its importance. In 2004, he broke his relatively new rule of no more speaking engagements and flew out to Chicago for the Society's 40th anniversary gala. Lee, I remember the note he wrote to you saying about when you invited him about a year earlier, saying, I know I'm going to hate myself for this, but yes, I can't refuse you. When he spoke at that 40th anniversary gala, he paid tribute to Lee Edwards and Ed Fulner, and above all, Don Lipsett, of whom he said, there was a benignity there which seemed to detoxify any malign culture that was stirring. The puffs from his pipe didn't exactly dissipate ideological or historical or philosophical differences, but they managed to convey to us that life would go on, strengthening the one impulse dormant in all of us, namely, that we would never permit anything that would disappoint Don Lipsett. Bill closed his remarks, I have been with you from the beginning, and my investment in our society has surely yielded an historic harvest. The Philadelphia Society, like ISI, like National Review, is dedicated to guarding the permanent things and handing them on to the next generation. And that is enough to ensure on Bill's part, I want to say undying gratitude, and I'm confident that I can indeed say that, even though Bill's earthly life has ended. I am also confident that he and Vic and Don, and maybe even Frank, if the idea wouldn't be too appalling to a Jewish quasi-atheist, are, even as we meet here, hymning the virtues of this society in the choir celestial.